Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples. Physicist Dave Rogstad is off today. On today's podcast is Dr. Kenneth Keithley, senior professor of theology at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Welcome, Dr. Keithley.
Glad to be with you.
So I want to talk about a topic that I think is very important, and I really want Ken to weigh in on, and that is, you know, when you look at 2020, the year that we have come through, a lot of people think, not just Christians, but lots of people think that maybe we're living in a new era, an era that involves change and conflict. And so I want to talk with Ken a little bit about how we came to where we are and whose philosophical ideas might we find as to the cause of our experience. So we'll tackle that subject. Joe and Ken, you know, the Germans have a term called Zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. You might define it as the general intellectual, moral, and cultural atmosphere of a given time period. One of the people that I appreciate quite a bit when it comes to cultural issues is the Princeton legal scholar Robert P. George. He is a Roman Catholic. He made a comment, Ken, where he said, if the medieval period was the age of faith and the Enlightenment was the age of reason, he says, we live in the era of feeling. And, I think most of us can recognize that the world in which we're living now seems to challenge traditional views of truth and moral goodness. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about how we got here. How is it that we have moved away from kind of traditional views of truth, goodness, and beauty, and how we have arrived at what we're calling this kind of postmodern moment?
Yeah, I say this often, and maybe said it on another program recently. I miss old-fashioned liberals, and I say that as a conservative evangelical. And what I mean by that is that old-fashioned classic liberals were modernist. And whenever evangelicals and liberals got into a disagreement about what is true, at least we both agreed that there is something that is true. We may think that the other person doesn't have the truth, but we at least agree that there is something objectively out there called the truth. And in this postmodern era, we do not believe that. This is one of the reasons why things have become so polarized and so volatile and so toxic, because truth is just a football. And if truth is simply a construct, a social construct, then whoever wins gets to decide what is true. So therefore, debates are no longer about arriving at the truth. It's all about winning and losing. I think I remember the tagline you have for your podcast is that, you know, we're not trying to, the goal is not victory, the goal is truth. Well, no, in this postmodern moment, that's completely overthrown. That's completely rejected. And so there's a way we got here somehow. This didn't, very few things happen in history in sharp right turns. And this is especially true in the history of ideas. We didn't just arrive at 2020 and get there. It took us quite a while to get here. There is a progression that one can see.
Now, what's interesting, Ken, is if you go back 2,500 years and you pick up Socrates he's having this very intense discussion, dialogue with a group known as the Sophists. And the Sophists are very good at rhetorical ability. And in fact, they're described as people who can make the worse argument appear the better. And they don't appear to think that you can arrive at ultimate truth, goodness, and beauty. They want to win the day. They want to persuade people, whether it involves deception or trickery or sleight of hand. I guess in one sense, I'm thinking that these ideas that permeate our culture today about being suspicious of truth claims and kind of dismissing any kind of absolute morality, that in many ways, this is a return to ideas we've seen a number of times, maybe with its own kind of 21st century spin. What do you think?
Yeah, well, when we go back to you know, the Hellenistic era, you find a variety of viewpoints there. As you mentioned, the Sophists, where you have, you know, everyone from the Stoics to the Epicureans. In fact, you know, you mentioned Robert George describing this as the time of emotion or feeling. One could argue that that actually goes back all the way to the Romantic era. N.T. Wright, and I think rightly so, says this is the Epicurean era, you know, what was actually being advocated by them. So you have in the ancient world, everything that, you know, all the various flavors and varieties, all the way from the ancient world up to here. But what I think you would agree with is that the classical philosophers won the day. In other words, the Platonic Aristotelian debate, that they affirmed that there is such a thing as universal truth. Mm-hmm. And there are these particular expressions of that truth that are reflections, are something of that nature. And so for the classic philosophers, all the way up through the New Testament era, up through the medieval era, was how do we integrate and how do we synthesize universal truth and are the particulars and the universals. That was that debate that goes on for centuries. That is something that that Christianity was able to operate within very, very comfortably. In other words, there is the universal truths. Well, that's in the mind of God.
Yeah.
And then there's the particular expression of that. Well, that's history. That's what we have, salvation history going on. That worldview, you could see whether it was Neoplatonic from Augustine. Augustine operated pretty much in a Neoplatonic worldview, all the way up to the Aristotelian challenge that Aquinas addresses. As long as we were dealing with the classical formulation, that operated pretty well. However, you know, we were talking about a postmodern era that we're in now. You can't be in a postmodern era unless there was a modernist era. Yeah. In between the classical era, and you have, we have a little segue with the nominalist, who the nominalists say, well, you know, there aren't universals, they're just particulars, you know. Yeah. You have all of these struggles going on. Probably the exemplar, or maybe even the beginning of the modern era, is in Descartes. Where you have Descartes, what does he do? And this is why many people call him the first modern man, is that he starts with himself, the individual. And he says, how do I know anything is true? And, you know, how do I know I'm not hallucinating? How do I know I'm not in an insane asylum and some demon is on my shoulder? How do I know I'm not in the Matrix? You know, the whole, how do I know? And so what does he do? He says, well, the only thing I can know is that I'm doubting. I doubt everything. Well, if I'm doubting, I must be thinking. And if I'm thinking, that means there must be an I who is thinking. And so there you have that famous saying, I think, therefore I am. And so he tries to start from himself. And that is the beginning of the Enlightenment modern project, is man will start with himself and arrive at the truth. And you have, and we can talk about, you know, going from Descartes to Hume to Kant to Whitehead, that progression in thinking. How does the individual arrive at the truth? And there is that belief that they can. I mean, that's why it's called the Age of Reason. They believe that that through, and they had remarkable success whenever Isaac Newton, through his brilliant mind, was able to arrive at the mathematical formulations that describe the planetary orbits. That was considered to be a remarkable success, and showed the power of reason. And that's why it's called the Age of Reason. They believed that they as individuals could arrive at the truth. It doesn't take too long before they realize, oops, maybe not. And so you have, you have, like I said, what with Descartes, you have, you know, what is man? He is a thinking being. Well, then you have David Hume come along, and Hume says, well, actually, what am I other than just this intersection of sensory perceptions? Mm-hmm. I am having all of these sensory inputs, and so I am that aggregate of that. And put that together, and that's all the self is. I am experiencing all of these sensations and perceptions, and that's what makes me who I am, that and the memory of my old perceptions. And so Hume completely rejects Descartes. And he says, rather than being a thinking person, I am an experiencing. Man is an experiencing being. And so you have with Descartes, you say he would be the exemplar of rationalism, the continental rationalism. With David Hume in Scotland, you'd say, well, here is the rise of British empiricism. Mm-hmm. And so now you have this debate, which is it? How do we know the truth? Is it through our rational faculties? Is it through our empirical perception? And then you have Immanuel Kant trying to synthesize the two. And he says, well, we're born with these rational faculties, but we fill it with sensory experiences. So he tries to have this, he tries to have it both ways. But the real thing he comes up with is actually how limited we are in what we can know. In other words, the only thing I can really know is that which is the phenomena. So if Descartes saw man as a thinking being and Hume saw man as an experiencing being, Kant says he's a very limited being. Now you could see, this is why Immanuel Kant is many times seen as the end of the Age of Reason, the end of the Enlightenment, because he's saying, well, guys, we're really not arriving at the truth. All we're arriving at is the best that our limited abilities can perceive. And that's not much. Mm-hmm. Well, then you have, of course, in the 19th century, the rise of Darwinism. And Darwinism, if anything else, it teaches that reality is constantly changing. It's the old adage, no one steps in the same river twice, that everything is in flux. Well, if that's what's going on, if reality is changing, then, and if truth corresponds to reality, then truth is evolving. And that means I'm in a constant state of becoming. And so you could see through the whole modernist period, there is this attempt to arrive at the truth, and it's not going well. You know, you have Descartes to Hume to Kant. Now you have with Whitehead and the whole idea of the universe is in flux and truth is morphing and changing before our very eyes. So by the time you get to the 20th century, we see the rise of someone like Heidegger, an existentialist, who say, well, truth is going to have to be whatever we make it.
Yeah.
And so what you have in the whole Enlightenment process, the whole modernist process, is this attempt for the individual to arrive at the truth. And what postmodernism is, it's a surrender. It's a despair. It's a giving up. There is no truth to find. And if there is, we can't find it. And so in many ways, postmodernism is a rejection of the modernist project.
Now, what I find interesting, Ken, is as you've kind of taken us through kind of an intellectual history, you know, starting in the ancient classical world, passing through Christian civilization all the way down to the Enlightenment era. So pre-modern, modern, now postmodern, if you will. I remember in 2020, there was a period during the pandemic, which the stock market was dropping 1,000 points a day. And I unfortunately was looking at my 401k. And
was a very existential moment, wasn't it?
I said to my wife, you know, couldn't you have talked me into being a banker or instead of a philosopher? But, you know, I actually, what I want to say is, I think ideas rule the world. And, you know, Christians have to be very interested in philosophy, if for no other reason, as C.S. Lewis notes, than to answer these very serious challenges to things like truth, goodness, and beauty. And, you know, I think going back a decade or so, I always wondered, is postmodernism something that is largely just in the universities by gray-haired old professors? Or is postmodernism something that is seeping down into culture and into society? And I really wasn't sure of that. But now I'm at a point where I think, Ken, we have to take ideas seriously. And when there are these very radical ideas at the university, the Christian church cannot ignore these kinds of things. And so if we think of this prism, these three transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty, which the classical world affirmed Aristotle, Plato, Christian civilization, Augustine, Anselm Aquinas, they grounded those things in the nature of God, in the person of the Logos. Well, Ken, today, I think if there's a prism, it's not truth, goodness, and beauty. It's probably race, gender, and class. Yeah. Now, I want you to go a little bit further here, because we live in a time of identity politics. And instead of identifying yourself as a person made in the image of God and having dignity and value, now we classify you according to race, according to gender, according to class. And, you know, I think that in many ways, that's a very different way of talking about human beings in these cases. So, take us a little further in this direction you're guiding us in.
Yeah, and you made a good point that here in 2021, we may be experiencing, you know, something that's a very strange postmodern environment or zeitgeist, but it didn't just drop from the sky.
Right.
And one can go back. I think Nietzsche, if nothing else, was so brilliantly insightful. He understood what it meant for the Enlightenment project to reject God. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, the classic way of viewing reality was to understand it in terms of truth, goodness, and beauty. But Nietzsche understood that these words really have no meaning if you don't have God. And that, so he talked about the death of God. And of course, you know, he's the famous philosopher who proclaimed God is dead. You have him tell the story about the madman visiting the village. His point was not that somehow God had suffered a coronary. His point was, is that the Western world had come to a point where it no longer understood itself to be under the guiding hand of providence. And so therefore, it was a world where they're trying to have progress, but they have no confidence in purpose. In other words, they don't have a teleological understanding of where the world is headed, at least not a divine teleology. They're going to substitute one. In fact, that's what every ideology is trying to do. Nietzsche understood what this meant. If God dies, so do we. Mm-hmm. Not in the sense that we have a coronary, but in the sense that humans and all of that dignified humans is gone. This is such an incredible thing. What are you left with? And Nietzsche said, all we're left with is the human will, the will to power. This, in other words, there is no truth. Truth doesn't exist. Goodness doesn't exist. Beauty doesn't exist. Those are empty, vacuous terms. In fact, actually, he goes a step further. They're not empty. They're just waiting to be filled by whoever has the courage to take control. Mm-hmm. And so whoever's in charge gets to fill those terms with meaning. So it's simply it's the will to power. So Nietzsche didn't just say God is dead. He also said, now let me tell you where we're headed. And he was so prescient in we live in a Nietzschean world. And it wasn't just Nietzsche. There was also someone like William James, who comes along just right after him, who is in the field of pragmatics. And what he argues is there is no such thing as truth. We just notice what works. Yeah. And if it works, we're going to give it the label of truth. We're just going to, it seems like every time we do this, we do A, we get result B. So therefore it's true. And so it becomes very utilitarian, completely pragmatic. And you can see if the European world in the 20th century was Nietzschean, the American world was pragmatic. And as long as things are working, you don't, what was the saying? I can remember growing up with this, you don't mess with success. Mm. So you have them very much proclaiming there's only whoever's in charge, whatever works. And then you have some Heidegger and the existentialist. You have the whole 20th century existentialist movement. What is it? Truth is going to be whatever you make it. You're going to have the courage to live in the moment, to make your truth, to establish that which is going to give your life meaning. There is no meaning other than that which you ascribe to it. And you have to have the guts to stand up for what you've decided, this is what has meaning to me. So as a result, we now see no difference between someone who spends his life building a great big ball of twine in the backyard and someone who gives their life in an orphanage helping those who are in dire need. There's no way to evaluate because we don't have anything left like this. So those men, even though they were 100 years ago, they were very much precursors of where we arrived. And I can tell you whose fault this is. I'm gonna have a little bit of fun here. I'm gonna tell you it's the French. We can blame the French. It's all, every time I see something happen, where somebody is mad on social media, where they've gone off the deep end here or there, I just throw up my hands and say, the French did it to us again. Mm. I'll be glad to explain what I mean by that, if you want to go further on that.
Well, yes. I want to give Joe an opportunity to jump in, but I I want to note for our listeners, you know, in this kind of reciting intellectual history, developing, you know, from pre-modern to modern to postmodern, you know, you talked about truth being related to reality, so a correspondence view of truth. That if my belief corresponds to reality, I know the truth. But then in American, especially American emphasis on pragmatism, no, truth is what works, what somehow benefits humanity. To then that kind of existential element, I remember asking my father what it was like as a combat soldier to finally get into Berlin in 1945. And he said to me, he said, I couldn't find an intact building. Western Europe was in rubble. And you begin to understand why people like Camus and Sartre and Heidegger look at human civilization and say, how do you find any ultimate purpose in any of this kind of thing? And so I really appreciate you kind of giving us a walkthrough how these ideas, our day to day didn't begin immediately. It's been coming. Joe, I want to let you in here and ask a few questions if you'd like.
Yeah, my first question is, you laid out a nice intellectual history, I'm sure partial, you can go on for a long time, but I think it'd be helpful as a layperson to see some demarcation points, if there are any, or overlap or what have you, because you mentioned different eras, ages, modernism, postmodernism. Can you give approximate dates for those so that we can understand? Then I have a follow-up.
Yeah, well, except they're not clean demarcations, because the history of ideas, they overlap. Mm-hmm. Ideas have a long time to germinate. But the classical era, of course, would be from ancient Greece, 3rd century BC. You know, by the time you have various permutations, varieties of Platonism, classical Platonism, and I would say the Platonic worldview ruled for almost for the first 800 years to 1,000 years of the church. And then you have an Aristotelian way of thinking, and it goes on up to nominalism. And by the time you come up to the Renaissance, that's why most people will say Descartes. They will say here is the beginning of the modern era, and that's in the 1600s. And you'll say here now we have, and with that. Then comes the Enlightenment, all the way up through the 19th century. It, you know, up into the early 20th century, this is a modernist era in which there is this confidence in the human ability to know the truth, to arrive at something that can be adequately called the truth. And you, like I said, there are so many characters that we could include in this conversation, but that's basically what's going on. The modern project is to start from the individual, the particular, and how do I arrive at that which is universally true? And it's a failure. There's no way that project could succeed. There's no way that I as an individual or we as a community could arrive at that which is transcendently true. That's just not going to happen. So you have then Nietzsche, would be at the end of the 19th century. William James would be the beginning of the 20th century. Heidegger would be right up through World War I and World War II. In fact, here's the interesting thing. Heidegger, Sartre, Camus, these are all existentialists. What really alarmed the existentialist on being true to yourself is when Heidegger, doggone him, he becomes a Nazi. He joins the Nazi party in the 1930s. And of course, that will be something that will hang over his head for the rest of his life. And it really does show the failure of just being true to yourself. What if being just true to yourself, you decide that means I need to join the battle for the fatherland? And so you have within the existentialist, Heidegger becomes a Nazi, Sartre becomes a communist, Camus says a pox on both your houses. And so you find that even the existentialist, that's not going to work. And so that's in the 20th century. But Sartre, at the end of his life, he begins to argue something very interesting. He begins to argue for who is arriving, who probably is arriving most closely to the truth. And he would say it would be the viewpoint of the least fortunate. In other words, whoever is the least fortunate in this scenario is the one probably who has a better idea of what's going on and what he's dealing with. You got to remember, as bad as it was to be in an American colony under the British, that pales in what it was like to be a French colony in Africa. And what the French did and what the Germans did in Africa and places such as that is really horrendous. The colonial history there is very much a black spot on Western history. We need to acknowledge that. Much of postmodern thinking is post-colonial and anti-colonial, where you have people from the majority world who are reacting very strongly against the oppression of the European colonial system. So what Sartre said, who probably has the best read on the truth? This is back in like in the 1950s. Think of a slave trader who has gone to Africa to get a boatload of slaves. You've got the investors in Britain who are paying for the sea captain and slave ship. And now you've got the captives down in the bottom of the ship, and they're traveling to wherever they're going, whether it's the United States or Brazil or the Caribbean, where they're gonna end up. Now, who of all of the parties involved, asked Sartre, has a better read on the true nature of this enterprise? Would it be the slave trader, the captain? Would it be the investors who are going to make money? Or is it the poor fellow in the bottom of the ship? Would he, what would be his opinion of everything that's going on? Whose opinion is the most authentic? That would be the word they would use. Who has the most authentic understanding of what's going on? And he would say, well, it's obviously whoever is the most oppressed, who is the most unfortunate. And so from Sartre, you see it within the French philosophers, whether it's Derrida, Foucault, others, there arise this notion, there is no truth. They're simply winners and losers. They're simply the oppressed and the oppressor. And we need to understand that, and this would be something that Foucault will argue very strongly, is that all claims to truth are actually attempts to control, to impose power. And so truth claims, and it's going back to Nietzsche, there is no such thing as truth. Well, then what are truth claims? They are attempts to control others and to keep them in line. And so whether it's the Ten Commandments, or the legal system, or the economic system, it is to make sure that the people at the top stay at the top and that the people underneath know their place and are subjugated and controlled. That is the postmodern reality that we're living in today.
And yeah. Notice, Joe, that Ken's humorous reference to focusing on the French, it is these French philosophers who they have great influence, Sartre, Derrida, Foucault.
Yeah.
So in many ways, there is this French philosophical side. But go ahead with your other question.
Lafayette, we are here. the follow-up question, Ken, here's the question. Why are we calling it the postmodern moment? Here's the background, at least in my mind. We live in a digital age, and it seems that things are coming and going so rapidly. I mean, look at your phone right now. You might be in need of a new phone because the technology becomes obsolescent very rapidly. Is that the case with ideas now as well? That ideas are, because we can disseminate them so rapidly around the world, do they fall out of fashion quickly, or is that a possibility? And if so, what is the role of the Christian? What can we do to ensure that Christianity is not just another fad?
Yeah, well, let's go back to your question about technology. Yes, technology is playing an ever-increasing role in this. And you got to remember, now if there's simply winners and losers, somebody like Sartre died, was it late 70s, early 80s, somewhere along in there. And you have Foucault and Derrida at the same period of time. So you're talking the latter part of the 20th century. And this is what is being taught in the universities. I can remember going to, attending classes and hearing this and thinking, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. And what do you know, a generation later, it's out in the public square. I guess we shouldn't be surprised. but what you have in this kind of system, in this technological advances, who am I? I mean, what did you say on, help me, Ken? You said truth, goodness, and beauty. Yep. It's been changed. It's now been exchanged with
race, gender, and class.
Yeah. So, what do we have in a system that is all about power? How is power exhibited? It's exhibited in race. We're talking slavery in America, racism. It's exhibited in class. You have the social unrest of socioeconomic resentment and everything from communism to fascism to socialism to capitalism, predatory capitalism. And then lastly, gender. And you have the first, it was the feminist revolution. It was Sartre's girlfriend or lifelong companion, Simone Bouvier, who wrote the book The Second Sex, which was the beginning of the feminist movement. And you have there the notion that gender are these power struggles. So now one finds his or her identity in one of those three ways. And here now goes back to your question on technology, Joe. What if you don't like your gender anymore? What if you don't like your, whatever it is? What if you reject to identify that way? What if you identify in another way? One of the things that we believe technology can do today is that it can change my identity. That's why you have gender transition. Brent Waters has got a great book called This Mortal Flesh. And he points out that what was expected of the medical world in the past was to alleviate the human condition. What we expect biomedical technology to do is to change the human condition. That I can be a better human being. In other words, my body can actually be augmented, changed. And so if I want to transition from male to female, I can do that. Now think about, what is being asserted and claimed in this day, it could not be done in any other period because it didn't have the technology or the means to do so. And so these kinds, I think that we will see ourselves, not just in vitro fertilization as we have today, they're looking forward to a period of time in which the womb is no longer necessary. The female womb is no longer necessary to bring a human being into the world. The goal there is to liberate. What is that going to do for us if we're able to have an incubator for a fetus outside a woman's body? I can promise you it will happen. And we will do it a lot. And it will absolutely transform the way we bring children into the world and what that means. So yes, technology is playing an extraordinary role in this postmodern moment in that we are expecting technology to bring about the biomedical changes that we desire.
Yeah. Another question. The term scientism comes to mind, but if I understand what both of you guys are saying, that doesn't seem consistent in my mind with postmodernism, but it seems that people hold to strong scientism. Whatever works is true. So is there a relation there, a connection, or did I miss something there about postmodernism?
Well, it is an interesting thing going on in the scientific community, in that they are having their own crisis. It would not be too much to say that within the scientific world, they're having their own crisis of faith, because there are a significant number of scientists that you'd have to call them old-fashioned modernist. They really do believe that they're dealing with something called truth, and that they reject, many of them reject God, or they reject the idea of biblical truth, but they still believe in a notion of truth, and they believe that science is the way to arrive at it, hence scientism. At the very same time, there is this revolution that is a postmodern revolution. And one can, just in reading the articles within scientific journals, there are accusations of racism. There's accusations of sexism. All of these accusations that is going on against Christianity. You also find that these accusations are being hurled at many of the scientific institutions which have really undergirded much of scientific process. Our progress of the last 100 years. So they're undergoing their own revolution, if you will.
Interesting. Thank you.
You know, what's interesting, Ken, and you're touching upon it here, the social sciences, the humanities, have been deeply influenced by the postmodern moment. But at RTB, we're beginning to see, I think, how these ideas are moving even into the STEM fields. There was a recent article in Scientific America that said, if you believe in creation, it's motivated by white supremacy. And even in the state of California, there are questions about what about the mathematical requirements? Should we lower them so that minority groups could have a better chance of succeeding? And I even noticed a month or so ago that Princeton University, to get into the classic program, their classics degree, you had to have intermediate Latin and Greek, and they dropped that. I wondered, what would Mortimer Adler and C.S. Lewis think of something like that? But I think that we're seeing, and again, I'm glad to have you here, because I want our listeners to appreciate that we live in a world of ideas, and ideas have real repercussions, and we haven't arrived at this moment suddenly. It's been coming over a long period of time, and I think if we're going to meet the challenge of the day, we need to value our educational systems, we need to value our systems of apologetics, of science. But you have a degree in mathematics. What do you see in terms of, again, these ideas moving into the STEM fields?
Yeah, well, and here's where I think that we have a real opportunity to be an effective Christian witness, in that we don't want to make the mistake of defending modernism. Mm-hmm. In other words, we don't want to simply be modernists, because the modernist enterprise was sub-Christian. And there were things about the modernist enterprise that we would oppose. I mean, Richard Dawkins, in my opinion, is a classic modernist. He's no friend of Christianity. And so, I don't want to make that mistake. And we also realize that this, the postmodern rejection or reaction against modernism, it does give us certain opportunities here to be a Christian witness, but we could end up with something even worse. And you think, well, how could that be possible? What could be worse than modernism and atheistic modernism? I'm almost reminded, what they said, that you one could reduce the history of Russia into 5 words, and then things got worse. That's not fair to them, of course, but you think, okay, modernism, and modernism gave rise to all the horrors of the 20th century, whether it's all of the ideologies, whether it was communism or fascism, all of those extremes. But it also gave us many good things that we as Christians would affirm, and that the technological advances and a robust paradigm to do science. In the same way, there are certain things that postmodernism identify that it's a classic case where someone identifies a genuine problem and then gives a terrible solution. And that's what I would say that the postmodernist does. Let's go back to Sartre and his illustration of, the slave in the belly of the sea galley. There is a real case to be made that there was a patriarchal, there was some social structures that really were unfair and unjust. I'm speaking as a Southern Baptist now, and we have to be, I'm keenly aware of our history. Both of my great-grandfathers fought for the Confederacy my great-great-grandfathers on my dad's side and my mom's side, both fought for the Confederacy during the Civil War. And there is a heritage of, the Southern Baptist Convention started over the slavery issue, and we were so wrong in the position we took, in that we unfortunately not only allowed slaves, but we tried to justify what we were doing. And then tragically, after the Civil War, many Southern Baptists were instrumental in setting up the Jim Crow era in the South. And then Southern Baptists, many, not all, but many were on the wrong side of the Civil Rights Movement and fought integration. So I have to be keenly aware that maybe the postmodern, there is a grain of truth here, that sometimes people in power try to control the narrative in order to make sure that we stay this way. And as a result, it's possible that I have some blind spots, that there are things that I haven't seen, and I need someone to speak truth into my life. Okay, I want to hear that. So for my brothers and sisters of color, whenever they talk to me about this is the lived experience for what it means to be a person of color in the United States, I've got to listen to that. I have a responsibility to listen to that. So having said all that, I don't think it's helpful, both as a society, and I think it is antithetical to the gospel, to see everything in terms of oppressor oppressed. I think that one cannot define truth in that way. Both, as they say, there are no postmodernists at 35,000 feet. it, you know, so what happens is that those who understand these issues of race, class, and gender, and they understand that there have been examples and egregious examples of oppressors oppressing the unfortunate. Here's the problem: if all you have is a hammer, that's the only tool you have in your kit, then everything's a nail. And guess what? Maybe mathematics isn't all about oppressor oppression. Maybe there's something else going on here. Mm. You know, 2 + 2 = 4 is not a racist statement. Mm. You know, so this is the problem of interpreting everything through one set of lenses. I do think that we ought to ask the question, why are people of color struggling to get into the STEM fields? That's a legitimate question. We do need to ask ourselves, is it because they don't have the opportunities? Is it because the school systems need to be improved? Are there things that we need to address that we haven't? That's a valid thing to ask. Do we want to say that mathematics and the idea of objective truth is an expression of white privilege? I don't think we want to go there. I mean, that's just nonsensical. That there's such a category error there that I don't even know how to respond to it. You know, that's like trying to ask me what color is the number 13. What does that even mean? And so I think that's where we're at in this kind of conversation.
I was at Walgreens the other day picking up a prescription, and I was looking at the doctor's instructions on the note, and I thought to myself, I wonder if Jacques Derrida deconstructs the prescription from the doctor. You know, after a while, when it comes to numbers and medicine, it's like, I don't think you want to undermine the development of math and, you know, science in that kind of context. But Ken, I think what's really meaningful here is and again, I bring it back because there are a lot of people who think, you know, philosophy is a waste of time. You know, don't let your kids grow up to be philosophers, you know, make them engineers or doctors or some respectable occupation. But the reality is that, I'm going to say it one more time, we didn't get here in a poof way. There are these ideas that have been laid down and developed. And I think Christian people have to recognize that thinking carefully and thinking critically is honoring to God and may help you know, people discover these kinds of truths. So, Ken, this has been great. I always love talking with you. You know, one of the compliments I'd like to give you is, as a theologian, you have a lot of facility. You're able to, you know, you understand the biblical languages and you can exegete the passage, but you're comfortable talking about historical theology and today philosophical theology. And I think that's the kind of theologian that I really, really appreciate. So thank you for being on our program, and thank you for being a visiting scholar. We really appreciate that you're part of that community at RTB.
Well, I've enjoyed the opportunity. Through the years that we've been involved, I've been involved with Reasons to Believe. You guys are a class act. I just love Hugh and Fuzz and you and the whole crew. You guys, you not only, like I said, I'm an old earth creationist, a progressive creationist myself. So we have an agreement there, but it isn't just that. I also appreciate the spirit in which you have your conversations and engage in dialogue. And that is so refreshing in this present environment. The good news is, and you know, Joe asked, will Christianity be swept away? The good news is the kingdom of God is going to, you know, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. I'm not worried about the church being swept away. I, I, I think that this is a real opportunity for us. The gospel can shine so very bright. I think that we have an opportunity to speak to both modernist and postmodernist who are involved in science and technology and say the Christian message provides so many things essential. The right world view for doing science. It provides the right ethical sanction for doing science. It provides the moral motivation for doing science. All of the things that we need to have a robust understanding of science, Christianity is uniquely equipped to do this. And so for those who are despairing of modernism and those I think will quickly despair of postmodernism, I would say, look to the gospel, which transcends every era. And I think that will be the answer that we have to give to them at this time. It's very exciting.
Very good.
That's an encouraging note to end on. Thank you for that, Ken. We've had the privilege of being joined by Dr. Ken Keithley, Senior Professor of Theology at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure to share the link and let people know about it. And let us know your comments and questions. You can reach Ken Samples via his Twitter handle at RTB_K Samples. And some of you have found Ken other ways like Facebook or reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com, where you can comment there as well. So thanks for that. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast, and you'll see Straight Thinking there. This is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.